The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. This broadcast is a kind of continuation or supplement to the last broadcast, which was entitled Some Myths About the Origins of World War II. In this broadcast, I'm going to be making some additional points about the background and the origins of the Second World War that I think deserve to be treated because of the way in which World War II plays a very important role in the prevailing narrative of 20th century history and is often cited by American political leaders in justifying American policy and actions today. In fact, over and over before the United States launches an attack against a country, you'll hear American politicians compare the leader of that country to Hitler just before World War II and the need to destroy that regime. This was done during the Vietnam War, for example, when Lyndon Johnson and American political leaders compared the leader of Vietnam to Hitler. It was done by George Bush, who compared Saddam Hussein in Iraq to Hitler. It's done by others who compare the leader, president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, to Hitler. And this is part of a prevailing, often repeated narrative of World War II history that is typified, for example, in the phrase that you'll hear in one form or another in American encyclopedias and American reference books, that Hitler plunged the world into World War II, or that he launched World War II, or that he began the Second World War. This often repeated claim is untrue. It is true, of course, that Germany and Hitler ordered the German forces to attack Poland on September 1st, 1939. But in doing so, Hitler had very limited aims in mind when the German forces crossed the border into Poland on that fateful day. It was the British and French declarations of war against Germany 2 days later that transformed a limited local conflict into a European-wide, even world conflict, because when Britain and France declared war against Germany, they didn't merely do so in the names of their own countries, they also did so in the names of their own empires. And one of the consequences of the British declaration of war was to bring into war countries that had no real role or interest in Central European affairs. When Britain declared war against Germany on September 3rd, 1939, London ordered that India, for example, had to declare war against Germany. South Africa was made to declare war against Germany. Canada, New Zealand, and other countries of the British Empire and Commonwealth also declared war against Germany. Now, the peoples of these countries, of course, in the case of India and South Africa and so forth, were never asked whether they even wanted to go to war against Germany. They did so because those countries were part of the British Empire. And that's what transformed the very limited conflict between Germany and Poland in 1939 into a European-wide, even world conflict, and later, which, of course, became a truly world war after later the Soviet Union and the United States became involved. Perhaps the greatest military historian of the 20th century is the British writer and military thinker Sir Basil Little Hart, who died in 1970. He had been an officer in the British forces in World War I, where he was engaged in other various battles, including the Battle of the Somme. But throughout the 1930s and until the end of his life, he was, above all, a military thinker and historian. He was at one time military correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph and defense military correspondent for the London Times. He was military editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica. He lectured at Cambridge University. He played a role in reorganizing British military before the outbreak of World War II, and was the author of more than 30 books, which had an enormous influence on shaping military thinking. Now, one of his greatest works is a thick volume entitled History of the Second World War, a work that I recommend very highly, because it's not only a very detailed, very intelligently put together and well-written book, but it's also very, very much presents a view of the outbreak of war very different than the prevailing common propaganda one that we're used to here in the United States. Right at the very beginning of the first chapter, he makes the point that when Britain and France declared war against Germany on September 3rd, 1939, they did so with two objects in mind. He writes, "The Western Allies entered the war with a twofold object. The immediate purpose was to fulfill their promise to preserve the independence of Poland. The ultimate purpose was to remove a potential menace to themselves, or so they thought, and thus ensure their own security. In the outcome, they failed in both purposes. Not only did Britain and France fail to prevent Poland from being overcome in the first place and partitioned between Germany and Russia, but after 6 years of war, which ended in apparent victory in 1945, Britain and France were forced to acquiesce in the domination of Poland by Soviet Russia, and thus abandoning the solemn pledges they had given to the Poles who had fought on their side during the war. At the same time, all effort that was put into the destruction of Hitlerite Germany resulted in a Europe so devastated and weakened in the process that its power of resistance was much reduced in the face of a fresh and greater menace, and Britain, in common with their European neighbors, had become a poor dependent of the United States." It's very important to understand and to emphasize over and over the fateful consequences of the British and French declarations of war, and how this is portrayed very, very differently by historians who have looked into it in contrast to how it's presented in the mass media. At the great Nuremberg trial of 1945-1946, Germany and the government headed by Hitler were portrayed as bellicose, warmongering regimes set upon a path right from the beginning of war and conquest. And in fact, as historian Basil Little Hart writes, and I'm quoting, "The last thing that Hitler wanted to produce was another great war. His people, and particularly his generals, were profoundly fearful of any such risk. The experience of World War I had scarred their minds." He makes the point that an examination of the very voluminous German archives captured by the Allies after the end of the war have been carefully examined and reveal an extraordinary degree, this is his words, of trepidation, that is of caution and fear and deep-seated distrust of Germany's capacity to wage a great war. Little Hart goes on to point out that if Hitler had really contemplated a general war involving Britain, he would have put every possible effort into building a navy capable of challenging Britain's command of the sea. But in fact, he did not even build up the German Navy to the limited scale visualized in the Anglo-German Naval Treaty of 1935. He constantly assured his admirals that they could discount any risk of war with Britain. And that's because, as I've been emphasizing, the last thing Hitler wanted was war with Britain and France or any kind of general and larger European conflict. Now, the immediate occasion or cause or for the outbreak of war in 1939 between Germany and Poland was the conflict and dispute over the city-state of Danzig, a city on the Baltic Sea that had been torn away from Germany after the end of the First World War and made a special city-state under the League of Nations. The population was overwhelmingly German and wanted to be part of the German Reich, and Poles absolutely refused to agree to any change in the status of Danzig. As Liddell Hart says, that what Germany was asking for, what Hitler was asking for, that is, that Danzig return to Germany and grant Germany a free route to East Prussia, that is, because the area was not contiguous, this was, as he puts it, a remarkably moderate demand in the circumstances. But in successive discussions that winter, that is of 38-39, Hitler found that the Poles were obstinately disinclined to make any such concession, and also had an inflated idea of their own strength. Even so, he continued to hope that they would come round after further negotiations. As late as March 25th of 1939, he told his army commander-in-chief that, quote, he did not wish to solve the Danzig problem by the use of force, but a change of mind on Hitler's part was produced by an unexpected British step that followed on a fresh step on his part in a different direction. And this was the fateful British guarantee, military guarantee to Poland, given at the end of March and then formalized into a treaty between Britain and France and Poland, that Britain would guarantee and pledge to come to Poland's aid if Poland's independence was threatened, as Poland saw it. Well, what this did, in reality, was make the Polish leaders refuse any kind of moderate settlement, any kind of diplomatic settlement, any kind of peaceful resolution of the conflict over Danzig and the corridor. As Liddell Hart writes, the unqualified terms of the guarantee by Britain placed Britain's destiny in the hands of Poland's rulers, men of very dubious and unstable judgment. Moreover, the guarantee was impossible to fulfill except with Russia's help, yet no preliminary steps were taken to find out whether Russia would give or Poland would accept such aid. Again, this was a fateful and dangerous situation because Britain's destiny, Britain's welfare, and that of France and of Europe was tied to the actions of leaders in Warsaw that were based on an unrealistic, utterly unrealistic sense of their own power and position vis-a-vis Germany. Liddell Hart writes, why did Poland's rulers accept such a fatal offer? That is, on the part of Britain. Partly because they had an absurdly exaggerated idea of the power of their out-of-date forces. They boastfully talked of a cavalry ride to Berlin, partly of personal factors. Colonel Beck, that was the Polish foreign minister, shortly afterwards said he had made up his mind to accept the British offer between two flicks of the ash off the cigarette he was smoking. He went on to explain that at his meeting with Hitler in January of 1939, he had found it hard to swallow Hitler's remark that Danzig must be handed back, that is, to Germany, and that when the British offer was communicated to him, he saw it and seized on it as a chance to give Hitler a slap in the face. This impulse was only too typical of the ways in which the fate of peoples is often decided. Now, Hitler, in fact, did not even make a decision to prepare the German army for an attack against Poland until after the fateful British guarantee was made. That is, after it became clear that Poland was absolutely uninterested in any diplomatic or peaceful resolution of the conflict. Now, Hitler himself, obviously, not only did the Poles miscalculate about their own military power vis-a-vis Germany, and not only did Britain and France miscalculate, but Hitler miscalculated as well. And as Little Hart writes, how could he do this? Hitler's solution was colored by his historically derived picture of the British, whom he regarded as cool-headed and rational, with their emotions controlled by their head. He, Hitler, felt that they would not dream of entering a war on behalf of Poland unless they could obtain Russia's support. So, following his hatred and fear of Bolshevism, Hitler bent his efforts and energies toward conciliating Russia and securing her abstention. It was a turnabout even more startling than Chamberlain's, and as fateful in its consequences. That is, shortly before the German attack against Poland, the German and Russian Soviet governments had agreed to a non-aggression pact. Hitler felt that this would absolutely guarantee that Britain and France would not declare war against Poland, because without Russia's support, Britain and France had no practical way of coming to the aid militarily of Poland if there was a conflict. Moreover, Hitler believed, and I'm quoting Little Hart, that the Soviet-German pact had the effect, contrary to what Hitler expected, of arousing a so-called bulldog spirit among the British, a blind determination regardless of the consequences. Of course, and this had fateful and terrible consequences for not only Britain, but also for Poland and all of Europe. So, on September 1st, German forces invaded Poland, and 2 days later, on Sunday the 3rd, the British government declared war on Germany in fulfillment of the guarantee it had earlier given to Poland. And 6 hours later, the French government, more hesitantly, followed the British lead. Now, the British expected that the Poles would be able to put up a stout resistance to the German attack, and there was a lot of wishful thinking in London and in Paris, but especially in London, that the war would cause a breakup in Germany and that the German government might fall apart. Britain and France and the United States, in fact the whole world, was astonished at the rapidity, the quickness with which Germany was able to subdue the Polish resistance. But this is not as surprising as it seems, because in numbers of men, Poland actually had a fairly large military, large enough to at least, most people expected, to halt the German advance and wear down the Germans enough that eventually, possibly, the force of France on Germany's western frontier would be able to be called into play and thereby defeat Germany. Now, he also makes the point, too, that on paper, the Allies had a larger military than Germany. Germany altogether had some 98 divisions in 1939, of which 36 were virtually untrained. But the Poles and French together had the equivalent of 130 divisions, a far larger number than the Germans have. And on the surface, Little Hart says, it would appear that the French had ample superiority to crush the German forces in the west and break through to the Rhine. But that's not how it worked, because even though the German forces were numerically smaller, and in fact Germany had fewer tanks even than did the British and French, and certainly together with the Poles, the Germans were much better trained, more creative in their use of the forces they did have, had a much higher morale, and were able, through much more intelligent use of their forces, to overcome the forces of the British, the French, and the Poles together. It was a legend and a myth that Germany had more tanks, and that the German tanks were heavy tanks and heavily armored and so forth. But the truth of the matter is very different. The French military in particular was characterized by a tremendous kind of complacency that proved very dangerous. The reason that Germany was able to defeat first Poland in September-October 1939, and then able to defeat France and Britain in the West in 1940, Littlehart sums up by saying, "The military issue can be summed up in two sentences. In the East, a hopelessly out-of-date army, that is the Polish army, was quickly disintegrated by a small tank force in combination with a superior air force, which put into practice a novel technique. At the same time in the West, a slow-motion army could not develop any effective pressure before it was too late." Now again, the main point, I think, to derive from the history of the Second World War by Basil Littlehart is that the notion that Hitler was preparing for a major war and a big attack is a myth, that Hitler did not want a major war. He certainly did not want war with Britain and France, and he was hoping that the localized conflict between Germany and Poland would not spread and become a larger one. Now, another book that contains a great deal of useful information on the outbreak of the war is by another historian, Leonard Mosley, entitled On Borrowed Time, How World War II Began. He makes the point that the decision by Hitler to have his military draw up plans for an attack on Poland were not made until April 3rd, that is, after the British guarantee against Poland. It was this fateful British guarantee, again, that made the Poles refuse and strengthen their resolve to turn down any diplomatic or peaceful settlement of the conflict over Danzig. Leonard Mosley also writes that it is difficult to find any virtue in the Anglo-British agreement at all, that is, the British guarantee to support Poland over the Danzig issue. It not only infuriated the Germans, it alienated the Russians, and it did not even achieve its primary objective of persuading Poland to join in a guarantee of Romania. 2 weeks after the Polish foreign minister returned to Poland, the British Prime Minister Chamberlain learned that the Polish envoy had lied to him and that he had been tricked. The Poles and the Germans were on the verge of war. And this conflict, this tension between Poland and Germany, was building throughout the winter of 38-39 and during the spring and summer of 1939. It was widely discussed and around the world commented upon that this issue would almost inevitably lead to war unless there was some resolution of the Danzig issue. In April 28, 1939, Hitler made a major speech in which he talked about the conflict between Poland and Germany. And he said, "All I wanted to do with Poland was reach a settlement with her. Poles and Germans have to live side by side, whether they like it or not. Do I want to prevent Poland from having access to the sea? Indeed, I do not. But we Germans have legitimate demands, too. Access to our own East Prussia, that is, the region that was detached, and the return of the German city of Danzig to the Reich. I tried to solve that problem. I made an unprecedented offer to Poland, and I repeat the terms, of an alliance between our two countries, and in return only the grant of road and rail facilities through the corridor and the return of the free city of Danzig to the country to whom it and its people belong. What happened? The Poles not only rejected the offer, but worse. They have begun to lend themselves, as the Czechs did last year, to the lying campaign against Germany. The international warmongers have drawn them into their camp. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, from the Big Apple to right here in D.C., let's keep that debate going with Chris Chambers, a journalism professor at the Georgetown University. Welcome, Chris.
Hi.
I couldn't help but laugh while watching that last piece because, I mean, look, years and years ago, probably long before I was born, there was this assumption that journalists were supposed to be unbiased, neutral parties that report
right.
the news. We obviously walked away from that long ago. But governments, of course, governments are ideological. They're ideological by definition. They have agendas to promote
sure.
and vested interests. So
sure.
What do you think of that?
The United States is a complicated kind of animal. There's never, we don't, aside from Voice of America and all that other apparatus, we don't have a state, you know, mouthpiece or, you know, that shoots out what, you know,
well,
the government
line. Well, depending on the party and power.
Well, that's true. But,
what, Fox.
But here's the thing. Is it what we really have are, is the government and other interests, most of the time it's corporate interests, big business, certain movements, you know, be it on the right or the left, you know, usually in the last 25, 30 years it's been on the right, using the media or people in the media, like pundits or certain shows, as proxies or chess pieces in their little war. So it's not like one big propaganda mouthpiece, you know, the stereotypical, you know, Hitler or Stalin kind of thing. It's a lot of weird, it's a chess game, but it's a chess game among giants. And the, you know, we become the little, we're not the pawns, we're the board, basically. And, you know, and you heard some of the people talk about the psychological aspect of it. It's that reptilian brain thing, the raw meat issue. It's the cognitive dissonance thing where, you know, I'm right and anything that comes into my brain that doesn't jive with what I'm about is bad, or it's propaganda, it's crap. So you mix all that together, and these people know this in the media, they know it in the government, and they market to us accordingly. So it's a chess game.
I mean, it sounds like a really bad thing, but at the same time, you know, this isn't the 60s or the 70s.
Right.
I mean, we don't just turn on our local 6 p.m. newscast, and that's all the media that we have. I mean, we could seek out other forms of information. There's Twitter. So
yeah, but
does that counterbalance sort of the...
Not well, it does and it doesn't. I mean... A lot of, well, you have adult Twitter, which are where people are forwarding articles, and then you have teenage Twitter where people are talking about Rihanna. But in the adult Twitter world, I mean, that content that's being bounced around still has a point of view. It's got to come from somewhere. And that chess game is being fought, online, in social media as well. I mean, Breitbart didn't have a newspaper or a TV station. He had a news site.
Right.
So, you know, you that's where this is coming from. So this is on all levels. And again, people are using them as proxies. I mean, the government, too. I mean, you go back to, the second Gulf War. The Bush administration had... ex-Pentagon generals on the payroll as pundits.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was quoting from a major address that Hitler gave in April of 1939, that is some months before the outbreak of war in September, in which he stressed the German grievances with regard to Poland over the Danzig and Corridor issues, the reasons why this issue might come to war, and why, and what the demands were, and what the problem was. But the impression that's given in much of the media and in textbooks and so forth about the outbreak of World War II is to give people the idea that Germany attacked suddenly on September 1st without any warning on the basis of a phony pretext, a false flag operation. That's a completely gross distortion of the reality, of the truth of the matter. And the fact is that the issues that led to the outbreak of war on September 1st, 1939, were well known and well understood for many months before the actual outbreak of fighting. During this period, in May, the Polish and French governments signed a military alliance in preparation for war between Poland and Germany. And France pledged that as soon as the German effort begins to concentrate against Poland, France will release an offensive action against Germany with her main forces, beginning on the 15th day after the first day of general mobilization in France. As historian Leonard Mosley points out, this was a downright deception. Neither the French General Gamelin nor the French General Staff had any intention of opening a second front on behalf of the Poles, and they had already conveyed this fact to the British earlier on. Again, this was the French had lied to the Poles. The Poles were fortified in their refusal of any peaceful settlement by pledges given by the French and British governments that proved, in reality, to be worthless when war actually broke out. During the months leading up to the German attack, there were continual efforts by the German government to try to reach a peaceful solution, a peaceful settlement of the dispute over Danzig, the corridor, and the growing problem of the persecution of ethnic German minority in Poland itself. One of those who played an important role in this was the League of Nations commissioner for Danzig, the Swiss diplomat Jakob Burckhardt. And Hitler emphasized to Burckhardt in private, and this is what Leonard Mosley describes it. His eyes blazing at Burckhardt, Hitler added that everything he was planning was fundamentally aimed at Soviet Russia. If the West, that is Britain and France, were so stupid and so blind as to attack Germany, he would be forced to join with Russia in order to turn against Britain and France. Then, with the power he had gained from this, he would attack Russia in turn. The point was, Hitler was always viewed throughout his career Soviet communism, Soviet Russia, as a mortal enemy, not only to Germany, but to all of Europe. This was, he made a temporary non-aggression pact with Soviet Russia in 1939, but his undying, his great wish was an alliance with Britain, and especially with Britain, but also with the other European states, and above all, with a common look at the danger posed to all of Europe by the Soviet Union. Often overlooked aspect of a lot of this was the problem of the persecution of the German ethnic minority in Poland during this time, and the increasingly intolerable situation and persecution that also contributed to Hitler's decision to attack on September 1st. But much of the pressure on Britain and France to go to war against Germany, much of the inclination, did not come from within Britain and France itself, but from outside, from the United States, and also because of the press campaign which even the British ambassador in London conceded was largely directed by Jews. Neville Henderson was the British ambassador to Berlin in 1939, and he said to Hitler, people clamor, but Chamberlain It isn't the British people, he said, who are anti-German. It comes from behind, from propaganda directed by Jews and anti-Nazis. This was the British ambassador himself acknowledging this. But others also understood in Europe just how senseless a general war would be and how this would be contrary to even Britain's best interests. The U.S. ambassador in London was Joseph Kennedy, father of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. At the time, he wrote, cabled a report to Washington on the attitude of the British, and he noted that even the British prime minister talked about the futility of it all is the thing that is frightful. After all, they, the British, cannot save the Poles. They can merely carry on a war of revenge that will mean the destruction of all of Europe. Therein lies much of the tragedy of this entire situation. Now, shortly before the outbreak of war, Britain and Poland signed a formal military alliance that pledged that the two countries would come to each other's aid in the event of attack. But this formal agreement between Britain and Poland had secret clauses that were not made public at the time. One was that if Poland was threatened by a European power, they would give each other mutual aid. But the secret clause stated that this European power named in the public part of the treaty was really Germany. And the second, the reference to the possibility of or threat of aggression against certain Polish interests meant, according to the secret clause, meant Danzig. That is, that the British formal guarantee to Poland laid out in this treaty was directed only against Germany, not against the Soviet Union, which attacked Poland in late September 1939, which points up the hypocrisy of the British claims that it was going to war in 1939 to support Polish independence or to uphold the principle of justice. And second, that the British were guaranteeing that any change in the status of Danzig, that is, a city that wanted to be joined with Germany, would not be tolerated by the British, even though publicly almost every leading person in Britain at the time acknowledged that German claims about Danzig were entirely justifiable and proper. Now, again, it's claimed that the German attack on September 1st came out of the blue and was prompted by a Polish border violation, a so-called false flag operation. Again, this is completely untrue. The issues behind the German attack were made very clear and public for months leading up to the actual outbreak of the war, and were laid out, for example, in a lengthy letter by Hitler to the French premier on August 27th, several days before the attack. And in this letter, he stressed that the mistreatment of the ethnic Germans, who of course, Germany regarded as fellow Germans, members of the same nation and people, could not be tolerated indefinitely. He said, "I have therefore formulated a clear-cut demand. Danzig and the corridor must return to Germany. The Macedonian, that is, the chaotic conditions on our eastern frontier, must disappear." That is, the mistreatment of the German minorities on the borders. "I see no other way of inducing Poland, which now believes itself unassailable under the protection of the guarantee, that is from Britain, to take steps toward a peaceable solution." And he made the point over and over that if there was to be a general war, it wouldn't because of what Germany was asking for, demanding for from Danzig. It would mean that if there was a general war, it would be because Britain and France had declared war against Germany over issues that did not involve their vital interests. Now, one of the key points is that during these fateful weeks, when it was possible, when it would have been possible to induce Poland on the part of Britain or France to come to a peaceful solution, Britain and France did no such thing. They did everything, in fact, to encourage the Poles in their intransigent, stubborn refusal to agree to any peaceful resolution of the conflict. As the historian Leonard Mosley points out, everyone has admitted that the German terms were reasonable. That's the word he uses. And they were, and they could have formed the basis of negotiation which might well have saved the world from World War II, at least in 1939. Again, he makes the point, and it's just one of numerous historians who have gone into this and have confirmed this basic point, that the unwillingness of Britain and France to any kind of peaceful settlement of this issue and instead to make Danzig a cause for war was crucial in transforming this localized conflict into a general one. Moreover, it was very clear that the Polish envoys and ambassadors refused to enter into any kind of even discussions about dealing with the Danzig and corridor issues in with any kind of diplomatic means at all, any kind of diplomatic solution. Now, one of the crucial points, again, made over and over, is that the Germans supposedly used the pretext of a Polish attack on the Gliwice radio station on August 31st as an excuse to attack Poland. Now, there's a great deal about this that's very confusing. At the Nuremberg trials, it was claimed that 12 or 13 Polish prisoners dressed in Polish uniforms were shot and made to appear to be perpetrators of an attack against this radio station so that Germany would have a pretext for going to war. But the German records themselves say nothing of the kind. There was a mention in the German media and in German records of a border incident on August 31st, but the official German white paper refers to the death of a single person, one fatality, not 12 or 13. But more than that, the generally chaotic and tense situation along the borders and among the German ethnic minority in Poland was not tied to or not dependent upon one single incident. Again, even though at Nuremberg it was claimed that 12 or 13 people were killed, in the German newspapers the next day, there was only a single mention of a border incident with no highlighting of any particular seriousness about Gliwice in particular. The German newsreel that came out just simply mentions that there was a border incident on Gliwice. So it's unclear what actually is being what actually happened in this regard. In any case, the Gliwice border case was not, as often claimed, a serious or significant or certainly the pretext or reason for an attack. The American historian David Hogan concludes that there is still a great deal of ambiguity about the actual circumstances of the Gliwice incident, but the important thing is to put it in a larger historical context. David Hogan also writes in his very lengthy book on the origins of the war, The Forced War, about the whole question of the persecution of the German minority. David Hogan, who I knew, received his PhD in history from Harvard University. And he was the author of a number of books, lived in California most of his life, and he was born in Portland, Oregon. His major book is The Forced War, which was praised by the American historian Harry Elmer Barnes. And in the book, David Hogan writes, "Polish provocation of Germany after March 31, 1939 was frequent and extreme, and Hitler soon had more than a sufficient justification to go to war with Poland on the basis of traditional practices among nations. Nevertheless, Hitler could not justify German action unless he believed that he was prepared to meet the consequences. He hoped to avoid war with Great Britain, and he knew that he would run a great risk of an Anglo-German war if he invaded Poland. It is for this reason that German-Polish relations became progressively worse over a long period before they produced a conflict. Hitler, who was usually very prompt and decisive in conducting German policy, showed considerable indecision before he finally decided to act and to face the consequences. He did not abandon his hope for a negotiated settlement with Poland until he realized that the outlook for such a settlement was completely hopeless." I want to put this in a kind of larger historical context, and that is to compare it with some other occasions when countries have gone to war. Now, Hitler certainly miscalculated in 1939 because he did not expect that Britain and France would declare war or certainly follow up with war when Germany attacked Poland. So on Hitler's part, it was a fateful and miscalculation. But if any country had a right or a justification, I should say, for going to war against another, the German justification for going to war against Poland was far weightier, far more valid than the justifications that America has used, for example, in many or most of its wars over history. For example, the United States declared war against Spain in 1899 because on the basis that U.S. battleship Maine had been blown up in Havana Harbor, even though there was no evidence that the Spaniards had carried out this attack. To this day, historians generally believe it was the result of probably a boiler explosion. But the United States had no vital interest involved in going to war against Spain when it did. The United States had no vital interest in declaring a war against Germany in 1917 during the First World War. The United States had no vital interest at stake when it went to war against Iraq in 2003. Even though the claims were made by American leaders at the time that Iraq represented an immediate and dangerous threat to American interests. All that was untrue. But again, wars are often made not because countries plan a larger war, but because they miscalculate. And this is often the case in history. Many people often assume that World War II must have been planned by someone because it was so awful and terrible. But very often in history, wars are not planned on anything like the scale that they eventually turn out to be. Nobody in 1860, for example, imagined that the American Civil War would turn into the horrible bloodletting that it turned out that it finally turned out to be. People in the Confederacy assumed and hoped that the North would, maybe after a skirmish or two, let the South secede in peace. In the North, it was assumed that one or two battles and the South would be subdued, but no one anticipated war on the scale that eventually it was. By the same token, no one in 1914 in Europe had any idea of the tremendous scale of death and destruction of the First World War when it began. And similarly, no one anticipated that World War II would become the great conflict that it turned out to be. But an important aspect of World War II in 1939 was the role of President Roosevelt and the United States in pressuring and encouraging Britain and France to support Poland in its attitude towards Germany. That is, Roosevelt's role in encouraging war in 1939. This has often been overlooked by historians. The American ambassador in Warsaw in 1938-39 was Anthony Biddle. He was an American banker and had been appointed to as ambassador to Warsaw by President Roosevelt, and he was a good friend of William Bullitt, another American envoy. 9 months before the outbreak of conflict, that is in December 1939, Ambassador Biddle told the Jakob Burckhardt, the Swiss High Commissioner for Danzig, that the Poles were ready to wage war over Danzig. They would counter the motorized strength of the German army with agile maneuverability. In April, he, Biddle, declared, a new crisis, that is April 1939, not since the torpedoing of the Lusitania in 1915 had such a religious hatred against Germany reigned in America as today. Chamberlain and Daladier, the British and French leaders, would be blown away by public opinion. In other words, Biddle was emphasizing America or Roosevelt's support for war in the hopes that this would bring down the Hitler government. In June 1939, that is months before the outbreak of war, President Roosevelt secretly proposed to the British that the United States should establish a patrol over the waters of the Western Atlantic with a review to denying them to the German Navy in the event of war. That is, before war had even broken out in Europe, Roosevelt was already telling the British how the United States would be involved in such a conflict. Many years after the war, the French foreign minister, who had been the French foreign minister in 1939, Georges Bonnet, confirmed the role of William Bullitt, President's deputy in Europe, in pushing France into war. In a letter he wrote to former U.S. Congressman Hamilton Fish, Bonnet wrote, "One thing is certain is that Bullitt in 1939 did everything he could to make France enter the war." Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota said in April 1941, he said that if war broke out, that the Second World War would one day be remembered as Roosevelt's war. He said, "If we are ever involved in this war, it will be called by future historians by only one title, the President's War, because every step of his, since his Chicago quarantine speech of October 1937, has been toward war." And this was also emphasized by the American historian Harry Elmer Barnes, who said that President Roosevelt had a major responsibility, both direct and indirect, for the outbreak of war in Europe by exerting pressure on France to stand up to Hitler as early as 1936 and pressuring both France and Britain in 1939 to refuse any negotiation over Danzig and to encourage war between Poland and Germany. Well, that concludes this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.